From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This Veterans Day, as we remember the service and sacrifice of American servicemen and women, we're taking the pulse of the country's military, how it has changed over the many years of deployment overseas, how the lives of troops and their families have been transformed, and where we are headed now at a time of swiftly changing technology, focus, strategy, training, and more. This hour on Point, America's military, past and future. You can join us on air or online. How are you spending this Veterans Day? Has the relationship between our country and its military transformed over the past decade? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Tom Bowman, National Desk reporter covering the Pentagon for NPR, where he's frequently traveled to Iraq and Afghanistan and embedded with U.S. soldiers and Marines. Tom Bowman, it's always great to have you. Welcome back to On Point.
Jane, good to be with you.
Also with us from Knoxville, Tennessee, is Captain Rosemary Mariner. She earned her wings as one of the U.S. Navy's first six female aviators in 1974, later becoming the first woman to command an aviation squadron. That was in the first Gulf War. She's now scholar in residence with the Center for War and Society and a lecturer in the History Department at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Captain Mariner, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Jane, for having me this Veterans Day.
So, Tom Bowman, let's start with you. Give us a picture on this Veterans Day of our military and our veterans today. How many people are serving in our armed forces, and where are they serving?
Well, right now you have 40,000 troops in Afghanistan, and that number is going to dwindle into next year. And, of course, there is still a decision about whether to have U.S. forces in Afghanistan after December 2014 when the combat mission ends. You have troops all over the world, really, aboard ship, on training exercises, and the active duty military is about 1.2 million. And in your introduction, you talked about how the military has changed over the past 10, 12 years. One of the things we see in particular is the combat experience of today's military. You'd have to go back to World War II, I think, to have a force that had this much combat experience. Mm. You know, six or seven tours when many Marines I know, several tours for soldiers. It really is quite remarkable.
So how have the last 12 years, that combat experience, the long deployments, the frequent rotations in Iraq and Afghanistan, how has that changed our troops, the lives of our troops?
Well, one of the sad ways it's changed them is with, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injuries. The VA estimates there are 1.3 million veterans who need some sort of mental health care. But again, with the combat experience, you also have a great number of leaders who, who don't have any sort of mental health issues. Some are running for Congress. Some have left the military and are going on to other careers in law and they're teaching. So it's really an incredible resilient force as well.
How do you see it, Captain Mariner? What's been the effect on families and communities of our servicemen and women over these last long 12 years?
Well, in East Tennessee, and certainly among my students, there's barely someone who hasn't been touched in usually a direct way with a family member or is a veteran themselves over the past 12 years, especially with the deployment of the National Guard. So it's influenced it in a personal level and also in their understanding of the nature of these kinds of limited wars.
Mm. Tom Bowman, how is our country doing at supporting and taking care of these veterans? You mentioned the PTSD issue, 1.3 million vets, I think you said, needing some sort of mental health care. What has our country done about that, and what more needs to change?
Well, they're spending a lot more money on Veterans Administration, but there's a huge backlog, as many of you may know. Hundreds of thousands are waiting sometimes up to a year for benefits and for assistance. There's a lack of psychiatrists and psychologists in particular to help some of these veterans. That continues to be a problem. So it's going to be a long-term effort. You have to remember, a lot of these guys and women are in their 20s and 30s. I've met Marines who have lost both legs in Afghanistan. You know, I was in a house with one of them out in California, and his toddlers are running around in front of him. Mm. And there he is sitting in a wheelchair. He's incredibly a great guy, decent guy. He's looking forward to this particular guy to working in martial arts. And his wife was really glad to have him home. But he's going to need, you know, counseling and prosthetics and other kinds of care, you know, for decades to come.
And Captain Mariner, I mean, this is such a good point. These are soldiers that are surviving wounds that certainly would have killed them even a decade ago.
Well, absolutely. And that means that as we remember veterans on this day and hopefully throughout the year, that we should make sure that the Veterans Administration has adequate funding to meet this demand.
Rosemary, one of the things you've studied is this simple notion of calling our soldiers warriors. Will you tell us about that?
Well, this is something that I first observed in the early 1980s, perhaps as a response to the anti-militarism of the 1970s. And at the time, I really didn't question it, but I was part of a study group several years later in which a Marine Corps general stood up and said, you know, I was at World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and we never called ourselves warriors. We were Marines. And then I started to study what that meant, and I think in the end it's a very unhealthy thing for the professional military, the regulars, or the citizen army, the Guard, to consider ourselves warriors. That has connotations of thugs, of brutality, of not being interested in the cause, of justifying many excesses, of war being an end in itself, and most importantly, that warriors are a privileged class, that they see themselves as above the rules. And that can lead to a lot of abuses, especially in a republic.
Well, and take that a step further, because I know you talk about this in the context of this epidemic of suicides that we have seen in the military, correct?
Well, one of the aspects of warrior cultures is what anthropologists used to refer to as a shame culture. But the idea that your self-worth is predicated by what other people say and think about you, so that it becomes more important to please your fellow soldier to have standing in the institution than it does to answer to your own conscience or your fellow citizens. So it becomes very important in that kind of world where you are your reputation to maintain that. And if you think you're falling short in some fashion, that in it, that can lead to some of the depression and feelings of inadequacy and anxiety that we hear people talk about.
Tom Bowman, how has the relationship between the military and civilian America changed over the last decade, would you say?
Well, I think it's different from the 1970s, as Captain Mariner said, when there was a real anti-military feeling, you know, in the years after the Vietnam War. Today, there's more support, I think, in the nation for the military. But, you know, it's sort of, it's a very thin support. You know, we go to ball games and there are a couple of veterans there. Everyone applauds. They put bumper stickers on their car. But it really is just, you know, it's a different culture. And less than 1% of the U.S. population serves in the military. So there still is that divide. Some would say it's growing more so than before. They don't, really have any connection with one another, you know. That's a real problem. And some people say, well, the military kind of has to get out there into more in civilian society so the regular population, civilian population, can get to know them better. And one of the things you're seeing now, interestingly, is a lot of the retired flag officers, generals, and admirals are now teaching at Ivy League colleges. And you wouldn't see that in the 1970s. At Columbia and at Harvard and Brown, some officers I know, senior ones, are teaching there today.
Captain Mariner, do you agree? Do you see the divide growing between military and civilian America?
Well, I do take a longer perspective. Yes, 1% of the population right now, but this has been a limited war over the last 12 years. So it's a 1% war, and you do not expect to see a larger segment of the population participating. And limited wars are designed to keep life normal at home. And if you look at the long-term run of American military history, throughout the 19th century and portions of the 20th century, very few people served in the regular army. They would have served in the militia or the U.S. volunteers or the National Guard in the 20th century. So, yes, there is a problem there. And I think when we do want to honor and recognize the service of veterans, we would better serve them if we would educate ourselves about these issues, both the requirements for the VA, the what the services are looking at in the upcoming 10 years, and to not go shopping, but maybe take your kids and visit a national cemetery and look at the headstones of all those veterans who have served.
As the army keeps rolling along. Then it's high, high day, the army's on its way. Count off the kings on the stump.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. On this Veterans Day, we're talking about the changing face of America's military. That's the Marines' hem behind us there. You can join the conversation. How is our country doing at taking care of our troops and our veterans? What about new reports of sexual assault in the military? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined this hour by NPR Pentagon reporter Tom Bowman and by Captain Rosemary Mariner, a scholar in residence with the Center for War and Society at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and one of the first six female aviators in the United States Navy. Also joining me now in our studio is Cindy Williams, formerly serving as assistant director in the Congressional Budget Office, co-author of Buying National Security, How America Plans and Pays for Its Global Role and Safety at Home. Now she's a principal research scientist at the Security Studies Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Cindy Williams, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Jane.
Let me play some clips here and then go straight to you. This is last Thursday in testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Army Chief of Staff General Ray Odierno said if Congress does not act and the sequestration cuts go unchanged, it would mean a weaker military.
The Army will be forced to make significant reductions in force, structure, and end strength. Such reductions will not allow us to execute the 2012 Defense Strategic Guidance and will make it very difficult to conduct even one sustained major combat operation.
And at that same committee hearing, Marine Corps Commandant General James Amos said that the sequestration cuts do have consequences.
We will have fewer forces, arriving less trained, arriving later to the fight. This would delay the buildup of combat power, allow the enemy more time to build its defenses, and would likely prolong combat operations altogether. This is a formula for more American casualties.
Cindy Williams, let's talk military budget. What cuts have come through sequestration already?
So these sequestration cuts come from an act that was passed in 2011 called the Budget Control Act of 2011. That act required basically two broad rounds of cuts for the military. The first was not so much a huge cutback, but a cutback relative to expectations. So where the military had assumed that its budget would continue to rise above inflation mm-hmm. for several years, they actually got trimmed every year for the coming decade compared with what they had been hoping for. So that cut's basically already been absorbed. And because of that cut, the services have already given up some things. The Army has given up the troops that it had added to handle the surge in Iraq, for example. The Marine Corps is giving up some of its Marines. But now there's a second big round of cuts coming, and we already started into it in March of this year. That was the sequestration that took hold. And basically, sequestration for the 2013 year cut about $40 billion from what otherwise would have been about a $550 billion budget, so a little less than 10%, so maybe 8% of the budget.
And so, Tom Bowman, practically speaking on the ground, Cindy says, you know, this first round has already been absorbed, Army and Marines giving up some of their troops. Second big round, $40 billion cut out of a $550 billion budget. Practically speaking, how do you see it? What has been the practical consequence?
Well, we don't know where the cuts are going to come from yet. I mean, one of the things about sequestration, they're across-the-board cuts. So everything gets cut. It's like mowing the lawn. Everything gets cut. So I think what the military and what some in Congress would hope is that you have to cut by X amount, but you can decide where to make those cuts. That's one thing that I think the military and some in Congress hope for. But as General Odierno said, the Army Chief of Staff, if they have to continue the sequestration cuts into next year, the Army may drop by as many as 70,000 more soldiers. They'd hope to get down to 490,000. They were at a high of 570,000 during the wars. They may have to get down to 420,000. And as he said in his testimony, they may have difficulty meeting the Pentagon strategy, which is to fight and win one war while holding off an adversary in another part of the world. He said, we might not be able to fight and win one. So it's the way he sees it, it's going to be incredibly difficult to, you know, maintain the current strategy.
So, Cindy Williams, are there any ways to avoid coming cuts?
The administration and Congress could all agree to get rid of the Budget Control Act of 2011. I think nobody is of a mind to do that. What people are talking about right now is that they might try to find a little workaround for the cuts that are supposed to take place in the fiscal year that started on October 1st that we're in right now. That's fiscal year 2014. So if they could, if everybody could agree to not do those, then maybe there would be a reprieve for 2014. I don't see any way that there would be a reprieve for the full decade, which is supposed to be the extent of these cuts.
Would it be possible, Cindy Williams, to lower the combat readiness of some of our troops in a way that is acceptable, that would not compromise the country's national security, as clearly we hear from General Odierno?
I think there are ways, and in fact, the Army has already started it, and the Navy is starting to look at ways to do that. The problem we have with the word readiness is as soon as you say we're going to reduce readiness in any way, people bring to mind what happened this year with the first round of sequestration cuts. And that was terrible. The military had deliberately not planned for the sequestration in hopes that it would be undone before they actually got to the moment of sequestration. And so the Navy was caught with ships that it had to return to port, ships that were in port already, almost headed for their missions that it had to keep in port. Every service had some mess that it had to deal with in readiness. But once you get past the notion that readiness has to look like this disorganized mess, I think there are readiness cutbacks that could be very salutary for the services. Things that are planned, things that are scheduled, things that you undertake with the full knowledge that after you do it, you won't have the full strength of your force to move forward to a war that minute, but that you can schedule it to rotate in later.
Planned, scheduled. Captain Marrier, has the readiness of the country to go to war, to take military action changed fundamentally, do you see?
From the long-range view, this is a typical issue, not the sequestration. That's a very disorganized approach. But after every major conflict, we have a period of demobilization. And there is this series of questions about what the peacetime mission should be for the Army, the Constitution says that the Army has to be funded by Congress at a two-year interval so that Congress is forced to revisit that issue. But you maintain a Navy. Navies have traditional peacetime missions. So the question is prepared for what, ready for what. But we have treaty requirements. We do have our war planning cycle. And in that peacetime interval, the service chiefs and the military departments and the combatant commanders have to look at being ready to do any number of things from, you know, planning from World War II or III, shall we say, on one extreme, to our everyday peacetime kinds of contingency operations. But with these kinds of erratic budget cuts and not knowing what's really coming, yes, I think our ability to do many missions is compromised right now.
I have a flood of calls coming in here. Let's get to some of them. Pascal is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Pascal, welcome to On Point.
Yes, hi, Jane. Hi. My disappointment is with the president. He is not promoting awareness of veterans' issues. I'm a blind veteran, served with all four branches over 24 years, working to promote veterans' issues here in central Kentucky. If you ask most people, what is a military veteran, you know what most people will say? Someone who served the government in the service. That's not the definition of a military veteran. The definition of a military veteran is someone who signed a blank check to Uncle Sam to put his life and limb in harm's way with no guarantees about anything. So there's a lot of things. I agree with the gentleman earlier. This public support for veterans is thin. It's very thin. And we're not getting the leadership from Washington and from the president.
Pascal, we pay tribute to you today, sir. Thank you very much for your call. Here's Hal in Littleton, Massachusetts. Hal, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. How you doing?
Hello. Go ahead.
I'm a veteran like that gentleman as well. I disagree with a couple of things about the leadership in the executive branch, but I'm actually, for Captain America, I'm a whale bubba who went through the FRS in 33 and then VQ2. But one of the big things I see is just the difference from even the time I was in on active duty. I got off active duty in Florida now, is that it's a dichotomy in that the technology allows families of service members to maintain intimate contact with them, while at the same time the general population is unbelievably ignorant and oblivious. I have a cousin, a first cousin, whose son just came back from deployment as a Marine infantryman, and they were in Skype contact almost every day when he was over there. When I was off in Rota, Spain, and going out on the ships, I didn't talk to my family for months. And we got letters. You know,
right.
Mail call was a big deal at sea.
Right.
You know, and that was only in the 80s.
So much has changed. Hal, thank you so much. It brings up an interesting point of technology, Tom Bowman. I mean, from the simplest things, but there are bigger technological changes that have occurred in the military over the past decade. Talk about some of those, Tom Bowman, and what's been the impact?
Well, you know, the huge impact is drone warfare that we've seen over the past decade. Armed drones, surveillance drones, there are a huge number of them now. And the pilots, those who fly these remotely from Nevada and the Predator drones, for example, fly over Afghanistan or Iraq. That's something that's completely new, and you're going to see more and more Air Force pilots flying drones remotely from a desk than actually in the cockpit. So that's one of the big changes we've seen over the years. You're seeing a more reliance on, we saw it in Afghanistan, these huge lumbering armored vehicles called MRAPs, to protect against mines. Those proliferated in Afghanistan, also in Iraq. So you're seeing the fights they're going to see in the future, in the coming decades, will be more guerrilla warfare, these more, you know, insurgent types of warfare, brushfire wars, if you will. You're not going to see really much tank-on-tank attacks like we saw, let's say, in Korea or World War II. So it's a different type of war, which is why in the coming years you're going to see more money spent on drones and also special operations forces like Green Berets and Navy SEALs as well. So it's a different kind of fight.
Cindy Williams, there's a training component to all this new technology, is there not?
Well, there is, because every time you have a new technology, you have to make sure that the troops are trained for it. And sometimes we make mistakes in the first instance. We have a history of deploying technology that's a little bit too hard to use in the field and having it basically rejected by the men and women who are serving and trying to use it. There's you know, back to the subject of technology, it strikes me that probably the most interesting technology that is coming down the pike these days goes back to this problem of austerity for the military. It's technology that the military is looking at as a way of saving money. Some of that is just the simplest things, like solar panels that would generate energy on a military base so that they wouldn't have
to rely on energy
yeah. bills as yeah. high as they are. You also see the Navy now starting to experiment with ship coatings that could make the ship move more efficiently through the water just as a way of saving fuel for that ship. Hmm. So we do see this sort of push on technologies as a way of saving money.
It's really interesting. Let's go back to the phones. Julie in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Julie. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My concern is that cutbacks don't affect our ability to take care of the health and welfare of the veterans. Proportionally, more minorities serve in the military, and they sacrifice an enormous amount. And so I think that the Veterans Health Care Administration is really our best hope at equitable health care. And so I think that that's an issue that needs to be considered.
Julie, thank you. Tom Bowman, would you speak to that again? You mentioned it a little bit as far as mental health, but the broader issue.
It's a huge issue. And, you know, people I talk with in the military and the Veterans Administration, they talk about the concern that in the coming years, when the knowledge of Afghanistan and Iraq begin to fade, that there's not going to be the public support for funding the Veterans Administration. And as I said, some of the guys I've talked with who have lost limbs, some have lost all their limbs. And again, this gets to the, you know, medical advances. These guys wouldn't have survived even maybe 10, 15 years ago. And they're going to require all sorts of care, physical care, mental health care for decades to come. So again, the real concern I see and hear from guys in the military and veterans is they're going to forget about us maybe 4, 5, 10 years down the road. That's a huge concern.
Captain Mariner, would you add to that?
Well, on the topic of veterans teaching military history, I just had the image of the 1932 Bonus March. This is an old issue, and the idea that veterans can be forgotten after wars is a longstanding concern, which is why going all the way back to the Revolutionary period and our veterans in the militia and in the Continental Army, there were pensions. There were provisions not only for the veterans who were injured but for those who were killed, their widows and their orphans. And so that, again, goes back to us as citizens supporting veterans. Let's, you know, inform the members that represent us that this is what our priorities are. Also on the technology, I think, you know, being Navy and being a pilot, that has a lot of implications for the future force.
With the U.S. Coast Guard song there behind me, this is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This Veterans Day, we're talking about the changing face of America's military. And we'd love to have you join the conversation. Are you concerned by the sequester's big Pentagon cuts? How do you think they affect our military readiness, our national security? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined this hour with a terrific panel, NPR Pentagon reporter Tom Bowman, Captain Rosemary Mariner, a scholar in residence with the Center for War and Society at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and one of the first female aviators in the U.S. Navy. Also by Cindy Williams, former assistant director of the Congressional Budget Office and now a principal research scientist here at MIT in Boston. Here's some sound speaking on June 4th, 2013, at the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing on sexual crimes in the armed services. Senator John McCain spoke about his reaction to reports of sexual assault.
A woman came to me and said her daughter wanted to join in the military, and could I give my unqualified support for her doing so? I could not. I cannot overstate my disgust and disappointment over the continued reports of sexual misconduct in our military.
Captain Mariner, speak about sexual assault in the military, and then more broadly, what changes women have witnessed over the last generation.
Well, when I hear these reports of this very high rate of sexual assault, and we're talking criminal activity here, I am reminded of, in the Vietnam era, of the fragging of officers. This is indicative of a major breakdown in good order, morale, and discipline, as we call it. So it's not just about women. There's something else going on here when this kind of criminal activity seems to be increasing, and the leadership, and I mean the 3- and 4-star leadership, is not held accountable for what's going on. The proposals that are in front to try to deal with this issue include taking out of the chain of command the rape cases and other assault cases. This is not something that I support. I think it needs to be kept in the chain of command. But I also think that to make that approach work, you have to hold the senior most levels of generals and admirals accountable, which means they get fired if they cannot prevent this kind of behavior from happening,
Captain,
or at least mitigate it.
Do you see this issue at all connected to the integration of women into frontline combat roles?
No. In fact, many of the cases have nothing to do with frontline combat roles. You're talking about, you know, entry-level training or recruiters or other cases. So, no, I think there's other things going on here that go back to this issue that we have misconduct across the board, and this is one aspect of it. Why it's increased, is there an attitude problem? We always talk about culture when we get into this subject, but historically, if you want to mitigate lynching of African Americans or criminal activities, then having more women doing more frontline duties and in more senior positions is one approach to normalizing the environment. But I think the biggest issue goes back to the accountability. Too few senior officers are held accountable.
Tom Bowman, talk about this question of taking sexual assault cases out of the chain of command, and how do you reform the system really from the inside, I guess?
Well, I think Captain Mariner is absolutely right that it's an accountability issue, that you have to hold senior admirals and generals accountable for this. You know, as she mentioned, you know, back in the early days with racism in the military, probably, you know, in the 1950s, I'm sure there were all sorts of racial jokes and attacks and this and that. You would never hear anything like that, today. You basically have to get the senior people focused on their chain of command and just saying, this will not be tolerated. Does everyone understand that? You call your people in, your colonels or your captains, and you say, I'm holding you, I want you to understand, if I see any sexual assaults or attacks or even bad jokes here, you will, it's on you. You know, it's going to be, I'm going to make sure that, you know, you don't get promoted. Do you understand? And the military understands that kind of thing. And the other thing is, do you take the sexual assault cases out of the chain of command? Some in Congress would like to see that happen, have it switched to a military prosecutor that's not in the chain of command. I'm not sure if that's going to happen. The Pentagon is against that, so it'll probably remain within the chain of command because, again, you want that commander to have control over everything within his or her chain.
Captain Mariner,
that's the reasoning.
Thank you, Tom. Captain Mariner, we had a caller who had to jump off but had a question about the role of the National Guard in our military activities. I know you've thought a lot about that. How does the National Guard stand today in the armed services role?
Well, I think we need to understand that the National Guard, first of all, is our citizen army. These are our traditional state-raised forces that are offered voluntarily into federal service, and that goes all the way back to the colonial era. The National Guard has had almost 500,000 people that have been deployed since 9/11. 50% of the National Guard are combat veterans. We need to appreciate and understand the fact that that is how the average American serves their country, and that that is very important to the balance of what civil-military relations is, to support those state-raised citizen armies. So I think the National Guard has a very long, proud record, and that they need to be very much on the table and perhaps pick up a larger share of the responsibilities in this upcoming 10 years.
A larger share of the responsibilities, Cindy Williams? I think many of them think, oh, my goodness, I'm doing a lot now anyway.
Well, they are doing a lot, but I think Captain Mariner's point is right, that they should be rewarded, at least as an institution, for doing that. She mentioned how many individuals have rotated into theater, have deployed, have been there, but virtually every Guard unit has participated, and as a result of that participation, we have now a thoroughly combat-seasoned Guard, and I'll say the same for the Reserve as well, thoroughly combat-seasoned and also extremely well-equipped. So where we used to let the Army older equipment, we would say it would flow down to the Guard, which was a way of saying that the Guard got hand-me-down.
Second-rate stuff, yeah.
Second-rate stuff from the active duty Army. During the wars, they've been almost entirely re-equipped with modern equipment. So the Guard right now is arguably in the best shape that it's been in, maybe even since World War II. Mm. And I think it is time to capitalize on those gains it's made.
Let's go back to the phones, get more callers in here. Keith in Bloomington, Illinois. Hi, Keith. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am a 24-year-old current serving member of the Army National Guard. I have just had a few comments. Number one, a few moments ago, I was listening to the show, and we were talking about the changing face of Army policy. And gentlemen there on your panel made the comment that the Army is changing from a traditional force-on-force to more of an insurgent on-force policy. However, and I don't mean to, I hope, sir, you don't think I'm trying to negate your experience nor your expertise on the issue. However, from a lower ranks perspective, I'm an E4. It's actually the complete opposite. We are being trained and being transitioned from an insurgent on force policy to a more traditional threat, force on force, to where we know who our enemy is. There is a uniform involved. They have a rank structure, so on and so forth. So the insurgent mentality is actually lessening when it comes to big army, so to speak. So that was my first comment. Secondly, technology. The technology I've encountered through many of my brothers being deployed in my service as well comes in when Facebook, social media, things like that are actually affecting our military negatively, I believe, because you have to take into consideration operational security, OPSEC. It's really a big problem when you consider things such as the Snowden case. You know, you have a lot of social media being involved, and unfortunately, I think that that's harming our security as a force. And if I could finally comment on the sexual harassment issue.
Okay.
I was on 7 months of active duty from starting in the end of December of last year, and finished up in the middle of June. And when during that period of time, we were on lockdown as far as being able to drink on post, drink after hours. Whenever you're in a training environment, the Army's policy is now is there is no drinking at all. It doesn't matter what your rank is. So my point in of that is the alcohol policy is being directly related to sexual harassment, sexual assault. And in my opinion, as humble as it may be, I think the responsibility rests on the soldiers of those in ranks next to the victims and the perpetrators.
All right, Keith, thank you. It is still a huge problem, though. I mean, alcohol or not, I think those who see it call it that way. Tom Bowman, let me let you get in here on Keith's point about the insurgency training. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, clearly for the past 10, 12 years, much of the training has been counterinsurgency training. You go to some of the bases around the country and the training ranges, they've created small Afghan villages or Iraqi villages with role players. Some of them actually Iraqi or Afghan nationals who would portray tribal elders, tribal leaders, officials. That's been going on for years and years now. But now they are returning to more of a conventional tank-on-tank training that you saw maybe before 9/11. But, you know, as I said, the defense strategy, when you read it and when you listen to what Pentagon leaders have been saying for years now, that the future is counterinsurgency, small guerrilla wars, not the kind of nation-on-nation war that we've seen in past decades. I mean, that's just what they're saying. As far as, social media, I think he's right. The time I spent in Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly Afghanistan, there was a great concern about people using Facebook and Twitter, and they would have to basically say to some of these guys, listen, you can't use this, you know, during this amount of time when you're ready to go on an operation. We want you to understand you can't say exactly where you are, maybe what you're doing. Just be very wary of that. So that it clearly is somewhat of a concern there.
Keith, I'm glad you called. Thank you very much, sir, and you take care. Rosemary Mariner, let me ask you about President Obama's so-called pivot to Asia. As we see a rising China, could we be looking at the increased importance of the U.S. Navy?
Of course.
Yes.
I have my biases.
Yes, you do.
And more aircraft carriers, too. But if you look at the sweep of peacetime planning and having to be prepared or trying to prepare and think out what might happen, it is natural, especially for the Navy and the Air Force, to look at what's called capabilities planning. So, yes, you have to be aware of how you would respond, what would be required in some possible future scenario. So looking to Asia and any part of the globe which raises peer forces, if they are investing a lot in their navies or in their land forces or in their air forces or in their space program, then that's certainly something that the active duty military has to look at and assess and think about mm-hmm. in terms of future planning.
And Cindy Williams, as the Navy might quote-unquote benefit from a pivot to Asia, how would the Army be impacted by something like that?
Well, that's TBD. We're going to find out exactly how that works. But if I were making the decisions, I would be reducing the Army more than I'd be reducing the Navy. And the Secretary of Defense, Secretary Chuck Hagel, has indicated that he is willing to consider that. It would be very different from the way that military budgets and forces have worked over the past multiple decades, because typically the services all get their same share of the budget from one year to the next. But I think it's they are considering it. I think it's the right thing to do to cut the Army somewhat more than the Navy.
Tom Bowman, let me squeeze in Don't Ask, Don't Tell here. Tell us how that's affected the military over the last generation in any significant way?
You know, it really hasn't. It's interesting, too, because I always assumed Don't Ask, Don't Tell would stay because, you know, nobody in Congress wanted to deal with it. They had to choose between, well-financed, gay and lesbian community, vocal, and the veterans community on the other side, also vocal and well-financed. And they never wanted to sort of jump into the fray on this issue. They just wanted to have nothing to do with it. And it was really Admiral Mike Mullen, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who came out and said, listen, this is wrong. I've known people since I graduated from the Naval Academy in 1968 who were gay. They had to lie about who they were. They were serving their country. They had to live a lie. And it was remarkable and dramatic testimony. He is the one that turned this thing around. But as far as the effect on the force today, I really don't see or hear much about it at all.
Captain Rosemary Mariner, I'll give you the last word here. Looking forward, give us a snapshot of what you see our American military looking like 10 years, 20 years down the road?
Well, I think it will get smaller. Both the Navy and the Air Force have become smaller in the last 10 years, so that they might increase a little bit. The Army will go down, which is the traditional pattern. But if I've learned anything in my years of doing this is that you expect the unexpected. My generation never thought that we would have a war in Iraq or Kuwait. I think that the next 10 years you might find yourself fighting in places that you did not anticipate, and you need to read a lot of history and get that kind of long-term perspective.
Cindy Williams, what would you say to our veterans on this Veterans Day?
I would say thank you very much for your service, and thank you very much to the people who are still in uniform serving us.
And Tom Bowman, for your last word, how do you see this day?
It's interesting. I was going through my Facebook, and it was remarkable how many pictures you saw of veterans, people I know, maybe in their 50s or 60s, old pictures of them in uniform, and then younger ones sending pictures from Afghanistan and Iraq. And it was really remarkable, and it's a good day to remember all of them.
Well, as the wife of a Navy veteran of the First Gulf War, I'm mindful of the sacrifices of many of you out there. We pay tribute to you. Thank you very much to our guest today, Captain Rosemary Mariner, a scholar in residence at the Center for War and Society at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Thank you very much, Captain.
Thank you, Jane.
Cindy Williams, Principal Research Scientist at MIT. Cindy, thank you.
Thank you.
And Tom Bowman, always nice to have you, Pentagon reporter for NPR. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. Here's Anchors Away from the United States Naval Academy. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.